You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's a lot of information out there about the novel coronavirus, and it can be tough to keep it all straight. We'll hear from a doctor at Mayo Clinic with answers to your questions on transmission, symptoms, possible treatments, and more. Now, the economic effects of the coronavirus outbreak have reached the U.S. food supply system, hitting farmers across the U.S. and here in Wisconsin. Dairy farmers have been forced to dump milk in some cases as demand from schools and restaurants has seen a huge drop. And now the Trump administration is stepping in with a federal aid program that will include billions of dollars in direct payments to farmers and ranchers across the country. Here's President Trump announcing that program earlier this month at the White House.
The program will include direct payments to farmers as well as mass purchases of dairy, meat, and agricultural produce to get that food to the people in need.
Ryan McCrimmon is an agriculture reporter who writes about the farm economy for Politico Pro. He's also the author of Politico's daily morning agriculture newsletter. Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you give us some of the broad outlines of this administration plan aimed at supporting farmers here?
Sure. So as you mentioned, there are two different pieces of this plan. It's about $19 billion in total. $16 billion will be essentially just direct payments to farmers. So these are farmers and ranchers who have seen their markets sort of disappear as the whole food system has been disrupted by this pandemic. And so the government is going to start sending out checks later in May to some of these farmers who have been hit the hardest. And then the other piece of the program is commodity purchases. So there's a lot of demand at food banks as unemployment has risen. And at the same time, as you mentioned, you have farmers dumping milk, dumping fresh produce in Florida. Really, this is happening across the country. So there's big gap between farmers who have an excess of food and a lot of demand for at food banks and other nonprofits. So the government is sort of stepping in to try to bridge that divide and purchase some of these commodities directly and then ship them to the food banks.
After past support for farmers affected by tariffs over the last couple of years, there were some concerns that a lot of the money went to wealthier, larger operations, to southern states at the expense of other states. Do we have a sense of how this money would be divvied out among kinds of operations and regions?
There are specific guidelines for where it's expected to go in terms of different types of farmers. For example, a lot of the money is set aside for livestock producers who have been among the hardest hit within agriculture. In terms of farm size, there are limits on the total money that can be sent to an individual farm per each crop or product that they produce. So there are payment caps, but there are not specific guidelines in terms of larger farms being excluded from the program. So this is the details are still sort of trickling out because the program has not been finalized yet, but there are a few sort of limits, and those that have been set up, there's actually a push by a lot of members of Congress to kind of unwind some of those restrictions on how much money can go to each farmer, because they think that a lot of members of the Senate and the House think that the program won't be as effective if you start putting a cap on how much each farmer can receive.
This is kind of a pivotal time in a lot of kinds of agriculture in the country with, you know, loans coming in, planting, that kind of thing. What's the timeline for this money to get to people as a lot of them need it probably sooner than later?
That's right. Yeah, there's a lot of anxiousness to really get this funding out there as soon as possible. So the Agriculture Department has accelerated the process. That said, we're not expecting checks to start going out from the government to farmers until the end of May at the earliest, and that's already a fairly ambitious timeline. It takes time to file some of the necessary documents in the Federal Register and things like that, get even the computer software up for farmers to apply and prove the sort of damage that they've incurred from the pandemic. So there's a lot of steps that go into this. So they're working fast, but aiming to get money out to farmers mid-May to late May or as late as June. But as you know, there's certainly a need for this quickly. This is something that's been going on since March, and a lot of farmers and ranchers are really hurting.
And you just said something that's an important distinction about this. Whereas there was that economic recovery spending passed by Congress that said, hey, everybody who makes under X amount of money, you're getting checks. In this case, it sounds like from what you're saying, farmers have to say, yeah, this is how coronavirus has affected my operation before they're eligible for that money. Do I have that right?
Yes, in general, it's known which parts of agriculture have been hit the hardest because you can track sort of the decline in commodity prices that trade on exchanges. So, you know, we know that dairy prices have fallen very steeply. We know that certain meat prices have fallen, at least at the farm level. So we know which groups will certainly have access to this. For other commodities that are, you know, there's some question about like hemp growers receiving aid through this program. For some farmers, they'll have to demonstrate specific losses. But for the biggest sort of groups, we know essentially where the funds are going to go.
Talking to Ryan McCrimmon from Politico, looking at federal funding aimed at helping farmers hurt by coronavirus and the various consequences of that. Some of the money also going to try to get commodities that farmers aren't able to sell because their customers aren't there anymore, maybe restaurants or schools, and trying to get it to places like food banks. And Ryan, let's talk about that part of the story in a little more detail. There's some logistics involved here in saying, okay, no, instead of that milk going to that processor, going to that restaurant chain, now it's going to food banks or the cheese or whatever the product is.
That's right. Yeah, there's a lot of logistical challenges because, you know, if you're dealing with perishable foods, and a lot of these farmers and food suppliers have these supply chains that they've been, you know, that they've set up after years and years of in the industry. And all of a sudden, all of these supply chains have been completely scrambled. Restaurants are closed, schools are closed. And a lot of farmers, I know dairy farmers in particular, sold a lot of their products to the food service sector, schools, restaurants. I've talked to some farmers in Florida who sold their crops to Disney World or to cruise lines, which are all, you know, they're not buying right now. So, and yet, as I mentioned, at the same time, there's this huge demand at food banks, especially amid the economic fallout. So really the challenge is to get food from A to B. There's plenty of food in the country. There's not a shortage, but it's that middle step, getting it from where it's grown to where it needs to be. And that comes with challenges, storing food, transporting it. So there's a lot that goes into that. So it could take some time.
I know there has been some criticism out there, Ryan, of the speed of the response from the USDA as this has developed. What kind of things have you seen?
Yeah, I mean, my colleague at Politico reported just yesterday that the department was sort of slow to step in when a lot of farmers and state officials had been calling for weeks for them to do something like this to sort of fill that middle ground. So, you know, it's been a month. It's been more than a month since this all started, and the commodity prices have really been falling and farmers have been feeling the pain. So there has been criticism that the department should have acted much sooner, while other federal agencies were sort of quickly scrambling to address this crisis. That has been one of the criticisms so far, that the agriculture department did not act fast enough.
Now, this is a moving target as we see meat processing plants closing, not because of government shutdowns, because they're essential businesses, but because of outbreaks of COVID-19 among their employees. And I guess that's creating new problems for livestock farmers now in this case. Is that something that we're hearing from the USDA on so far?
Absolutely. That's one of the biggest concerns, is that, you know, if these plants shut down, that puts a strain on the meat supply. And, you know, there's nowhere for the people who are actually raising these animals to sell them. And that is one of the biggest concerns right now, which is why you see a lot of the money in this aid package is sort of earmarked towards livestock producers, because they have been among the most affected by the pandemic, along with dairy farmers and sort of the fresh produce growers in Florida, California, and around the country.
As we wrap up, Ryan, what do you have your eye on next?
What I'm watching next is what follows this first initial stimulus package. Congress is going to come back in session pretty soon, and we know that there's already a lot of calls for a lot more money than what was already provided for agriculture. So the first stimulus package, Congress gave the Agriculture Department about $23 billion total in additional spending authority. There have been calls already from a lot of members of Congress for about $50 billion more. So there's a lot of pressure, not only for more money, but to address certain parts of the industry that were sort of left out of the first stimulus package. There was a huge push to get aid for the ethanol industry, which has been affected by the slowdown, the complete drop off in driving. So there's been less gasoline consumption, which has therefore affected ethanol demand, and that's been a very, very challenging sector. So there's a lot of interest in helping ethanol and other groups as well.
Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Ryan McCrimmon with Politico Pro's daily morning agriculture newsletter with us today to take us through federal aid programs aimed at helping farmers affected by coronavirus. Coming up, we'll find out how infectious diseases helped create the look of the modern bathroom. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how disease prevention played a big role in creating the modern bathroom. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with stories about random acts of kindness.
We've heard stories lately about people creating sidewalk and window art for neighbors passing by, a friend delivering flowers to a buddy who's homebound. These acts of kindness can feel so simple, but right now are touching us in much deeper ways. We asked our listeners to tell us about the goodness, joy, and love they've recently experienced. Here's what they had to say.
Well, hi, Maureen. This is Linda Beeth. I'm calling from Bayview in Milwaukee, and I have a couple. One was our Bayview community on New York Avenue. One of our neighbors passed around kazoos, and she has a list of songs we're going to play from our front porch using the kazoos she bought each one of us. So I think that was fun.
My name is Ian Lowe from Madison, Wisconsin. A friend and colleague of mine left a six-pack of beer on my front porch. It is New Glarus Brewing Company's Cabin Fever, so it was perfect. And I was, at the time, struggling to put my three-year-old daughter down for a nap. And so, needless to say, it came at just the right time.
And about 3 weeks ago, I went to Target. My mind was on everything that's going on. Did not think about anything but getting a cart and getting in and out as quickly as possible. I grabbed the first cart I saw. And then I noticed I had grabbed a cart that a young man had just cleaned off for himself. And once I did put two and two together, he very politely said, "I just cleaned this for you." And it was just such a gift.
Hi, my name is Kate Duchateau. I'm a resident of Lake Mills, Wisconsin, and I work as a nurse in Madison. Because of the COVID-19 crisis, nurses are required to wear masks continuously, and that creates a lot of discomfort and broken skin integrity by the ears. So many of us have taken to wearing headbands with buttons on them to strap the face mask onto. I reached out to a local seamstress and business owner named Amy Slattery of Bugaboodles in Lake Mills to see if she would do the service. And when I asked her how much it was going to cost, she said it would be absolutely free, not to worry about it. And I thought that was pretty kind of her to do. As a small business owner, she is certainly taking a hit right now with the stay-at-home orders. And I know that she needs every penny that she can get.
This is Jennifer from Madison. Bagpipers from around the world coordinated to play their pipes last Sunday at 2 p.m. in support of healthcare workers. My husband, who's a bagpiper, played at three different fire stations for the EMTs.
Hello. My name is Nishant Jain, of Chicago and formerly Eau Claire. People know me around those parts as the sneaky artist. I've been asking people in my neighborhood to send me pictures of their work-from-home setups. And I'd send them in return drawings of these makeshift desks and workspaces inside kitchens, inside closets, inside living rooms with children and pets all at the same place. I found that this is a good way to help people deal with their own problems and the unique challenges that this crisis has thrown upon so many working professionals. And also for me to distract myself from my phone. It gets me to do something positive. It gets me to focus on drawing and art and productive things for my brain than anxiety and worry over the state of the world.
Thank you so much to our listeners for sharing their random acts of kindness with us. Do you have a story you want to share? Go to wisconsinlife.org to find more details or email us at wisconsinlife@wpr.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, infectious diseases have given us the urgency to make advances in a lot of different areas, food, medicine, even bathroom design. As our understanding of diseases like tuberculosis and cholera advanced during the 19th century, so did our bathrooms. Many of the design features we're familiar with today were inspired, at least in part, by keeping ourselves safe from germs. Elizabeth Yuko is a bioethicist, writer, and adjunct professor of ethics at Fordham University. Her recent piece for City Lab is called How Infectious Disease Defined the American Bathroom. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, you point out that the modern bathroom as we know it hasn't existed that long in the scope of things. It originally started as a public health measure, right? Can you talk about that?
Sure. So the first homes that had indoor plumbing and indoor bathrooms were, not surprisingly, owned by the wealthy. And in order to make these rooms look like any other room in a Victorian home, the fixtures were encased in wood. So the toilet was inside of a wooden box with a lid that closed so no one knew what you were doing in there. Same with the sink, the bathroom, or bathtub, excuse me, and other parts. So that was not the most sanitary. And wood being porous is difficult to clean. And once germ theory really started taking off and people understood how we were starting to get sick, then people started using design as a way to help keep themselves healthy.
So that takes us away from wood and into sort of the shiny white porcelain chrome surfaces. Could you talk about why we went that way?
Absolutely. And there's a Wisconsin connection for you, because in 1883, Kohler created their sanitary enamel, which was really used to replace wood as the sanitary, easy to clean material for making bathroom fixtures. And so we saw that in toilets and sinks and bathtubs. And the idea here was to be able to wipe everything clean as soon as possible, or as quickly as possible. And everything was in light colors, so you're able to spot dirt as well.
And then another development was the half bath, again, in response to disease. How did those come to be?
So this is, you know, the beginning of the 20th century after the 1918 flu pandemic, and kind of in the midst of tuberculosis being a major, major public health concern, you had, again, wealthier houses with indoor bathrooms, but they were typically on the second floor of the house near where the bedrooms were. But this was also the time when you had daily deliveries of coal and ice and a delivery person coming into your home every day after traipsing around the neighborhood, you know, going into other neighbors' houses who may have been infected with some sort of infectious disease. And so some homes started to install half baths right as you walk into the home. Some people also refer to them as a powder room. And the goal of this room was to be able to have a place for these delivery people, as well as any other guests who come to your home, to be able to wash off and use a bathroom without going into the family's private space.
Another thing we lost along the way, especially in those bathrooms, it sounds like, was wallpaper. Why did that go away?
Yes. So one of the my favorite things I learned while researching this is that one of the reasons Victorian era wallpaper was so busy was to keep fly marks from showing up. So there were so many flies at the time that, you know, they would congregate in the wall, and if you squished them, they would leave a mark. So to make their homes look cleaner, they had these elaborately patterned wallpaper designs. So that was the first thing. So when there's this switch to everything being white and sterile, that wallpaper had to go. That's number one. Number two, there's also arsenic in some of the wallpaper. So that was its own kind of public health concern. And it was also damp and just not the most sanitary. So wallpaper is taken down and walls are either painted white or tiles were put up, usually white or other light colors.
Here we are in the midst of this COVID-19 pandemic. Is there a thought that this may start reshaping our bathrooms, how they work and where we put sinks and things like that?
Yes, I think so. One of the people I interviewed for the CityLab article, Lloyd Alter, he has predicted the rise of the vestibule or the mudroom as this kind of transition space between the outside and the inside of the home, where the main feature would be some sort of sink where you're able to wash your hands. So that, I think, will be more common. And just we're just spending more time in our bathroom now, or at least ideally we are, you know, washing our hands constantly, staring at the room as we're, you know, counting our 20 seconds. And that just might inspire us to change the decor of the bathroom or to make it more user-friendly, especially if we're preparing to possibly be stuck in our homes again for weeks or months at a time in the future.
I want to check in on one brief detour. You write that as we had antibiotics and feared diseases less, there's that trend in the 70s for some reason of carpeted bathrooms.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, we kind of got a little bit lax as a society when it came to bathroom hygiene. We no longer, you know, had to rely on home design to keep us healthy. We had antibiotics and other types of medications. And so at that point, the focus was more on style and decor than it was on functionality. So that's when you saw carpeting installed in bathrooms, the fuzzy toilet seat covers, which sometimes also came with like that matching rug that was cut out to fit perfectly around your toilet. So yeah, fortunately, from a style perspective, those are not here anymore. And from a germ perspective, also good that they're in the past.
Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us today. Really interesting.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Elizabeth Yuko is a bioethicist, writer, and adjunct professor of ethics at Fordham University. She joined us for a look at her recent piece for CityLab, How Infectious Disease Shaped the American Bathroom. I just drew up these plans for a bathroom with, like, you know, wood casing for everything and the wallpaper and the carpet. This is back to the drawing board now. Coming up, an infectious disease specialist will share what we're learning about COVID-19 and answer your questions about the illness, how it spread, and possible treatments in the future. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, the influenza outbreak that came to be called misleadingly Spanish flu swept across the world just over a century ago. Kate Archer-Kent talks to the author of a new book about that epidemic and possible lessons for today. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Now, news about our current pandemic is moving fast with new numbers out every day and a lot of talk about potential treatments and where we stand on containing the novel coronavirus. We've been having regular check-ins here on Central Time with doctors and public health experts for a look at the latest information and misinformation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about COVID-19 symptoms and treatment, how the novel coronavirus spreads, or the response from hospitals and labs? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. John Ohoro is an infectious disease specialist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester. He also works at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse and is a graduate of the University of Wisconsin and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Ohoro, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with testing, a major point of concern in getting a handle on this outbreak. What kind of progress are we seeing in the availability of tests and our capacity to administer and then process them?
Sure. Testing capacity is really ramping up nationwide and in Wisconsin in particular. And we're starting to see some of the benefits from that just in terms of the case numbers that are being reported in the past several days. There's been more testing, and although the cases are up, a lot of that reflects the fact that we're now able to test more cases. As of yet, we would like to see the testing capacity nationwide and in every state really improve even further yet. The more we can test people, the more we can isolate cases and prevent further spread. But having said that, it has been moving in a positive direction over the past few days to week.
Are we getting close to a point where we can be testing more people who are asymptomatic to see if they have the virus, even though they're not showing signs of it, or people who are kind of borderline cases? so we can get from that broad brush, everybody stay home policy to a place where we can say, okay, things are closer to normal, and then we can find the people who have it and have them stay home?
We're getting closer to that, but I wouldn't say that we're quite close to it at this point. The more testing capacity we have, the more discretion we have to use it in cases where the suspicion may be a little bit higher, even though they don't meet traditional risk factors, like testing someone who has a close contact with a known case, for example, who might not be exhibiting typical symptoms. And we are able to test more of those patients now than we were a month ago or even 2 weeks ago. But we're not yet at the point where we can start doing any kind of blanket testing. We still have to apply a great deal of discretion to make sure we're using this test appropriately and in the patients who we have the highest suspicion of infection.
Now, something that's come up in the last few days, and I know health departments are getting calls about this, the president had brought up the possibility of apparently testing the use of disinfectant inside the body as a way to get rid of coronavirus. And he said afterward he'd been sarcastic, but to be clear, internal use of the things we're using to disinfect, packaging or tables or whatever, we don't want to do that, right?
Medical role for ingesting any sort of household cleaner or bleach product or anything similar, or ammonia product, anything similar to that. None of those will have any benefit in terms of trying to clear an infection of COVID or any other kind of benefit. And as of right now, the same goes for any kind of UV or light therapy in that same vein. There's not a light therapy, which also had been discussed in that same sort of vein. Both of those are very effective tools for cleaning the environment and are used extensively in hospitals and in other areas to prevent spread from virus that's sticking around on surfaces. But they're very toxic to viruses, and that's how they work, and they're very toxic to us as well. And ideally, we pick treatments that are less toxic to us than they are to the virus.
And we've seen cases. I know there was a problem in Iran, for example, with people seeking out a bootleg alcohol, not safe for human consumption type stuff, and having deaths because of that. So can you talk about the importance of getting that message out? Drinking anything really isn't going to kill this virus. Drinking stuff that's bad for you obviously is bad for you. Just do you want to hammer that home a wee bit more?
Absolutely. There is, as of yet, no known cure or preventive thing that you can take or ingest that will really help clear COVID or prevent COVID. There's plenty of areas of research for that, but within that, there is no role for any of these sort of toxic treatments, none of these household cleansers, none of the home-brewed, high-concentration alcohol. Those things are poisonous, and they will remain poisonous well after COVID.
And just briefly, I've heard of cases of people having rashes from using these products. And again, in this case, I think not intentionally putting them on people's hands or faces to try to kill the virus, but just while cleaning with these things, not taking enough precautions. These aren't even all that safe for external use on humans, right?
Well, that all depends on which product we're talking about, and it's always important to review the manufacturer's instructions. Some require gloves in order to wipe down if you're talking about some certain hospital-grade disinfectants. Some of them are very generic ones that are used on surfaces in households. They're all equally important to read those instructions. Some are more toxic than others and ingested, but none of them should be ingested, whether we're talking about a mild household cleanser or a hospital-grade bleach.
Talking to Dr. John Ohoro from the Mayo Clinic, taking your questions now about COVID-19 and the novel coronavirus that causes that illness. Let's go to Mary Kay. Nope, looks like we're losing Mary Kay. Let's go to Tom in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
I'd like to know a little bit more about the mechanism that makes people with high blood pressure more vulnerable to complications, and does it depend on how high the blood pressure is or if one's taking medication?
Sure. There's a lot of interesting associations that we're starting to understand a little bit better about COVID-19 and who does better with it, and more importantly, who's at higher risk for a poor outcome. One of the groups that we've found that is at higher risk is patients who have any kind of cardiovascular disease. Part of this might be because having any kind of cardiac disease, whether it's from high blood pressure or heart disease, just makes it so you have less reserve, less ability for your body to cope with a severe infection. But there's also some evidence that COVID may actually directly infect heart tissue in some people. So for someone who has high blood pressure, there is some increased risk of their heart just not being able to keep up with that kind of strain. Interestingly, there are some blood pressure medications that are also being looked at for protective effect, but none of those are yet anywhere near definite enough for them to be recommended to be started for someone who's not already on them. But overall, this seems to be just a marker for heart disease, and that's our current understanding of that association.
Thanks for that call. Let's go to Mary Kay now in Kenosha. My mistake, Mary Kay. You've been there the whole time. Hi.
I'd like to ask a few questions. The first one is the masks. If we were to have a regional mandatory mask in public and start manufacturing ones you only wear in public, like when you're going to the grocery store or going to work, wouldn't that, until there's a cure, wouldn't that help a lot? That's the first thing.
Sure. The masking, the role of masking is important right now, but it's important to understand what the masks that are generally being used in the public are really good for. The cloth masks that most people are wearing and should be wearing right now are really to limit the spread of any coughs or sneezes and prevent us from touching our own face before we touch anything else. So what they really do is protect the rest of the world from us. It's something that you should wear out of consideration for others, as opposed to the kind of higher grade filtering masks that are worn in some of the procedural areas of the hospital, or even the surgical masks that are intended to provide true protection to healthcare staff. So having said that, there is a lot of value to wearing those masks because it does help limit some of the potential for spread by containing your coughs and sneezes to yourself. So if you are early on in the illness and you don't know it, you have less potential of spreading it to others. It's an adjunct to, but not a replacement for, some of the social distancing measures. It's important to wear them when social distancing is a little bit more relaxed. But because these aren't perfect filters, they aren't going to reach the point right now, at least, where we can say that it's going to be a substitute for avoiding avoiding mass gatherings and such.
Thanks for that call, Mary Kay. I've got a note. Mary Kay also is wondering if vinegar was an effective substance for cleaning surfaces to try to make sure the virus wasn't living on them.
It wouldn't be my preferred substance for it. I would honestly have to look up what the concentration of vinegar that would be effective as a cleaner is, but I don't know that offhand, but I suspect it's higher than anyone would really be comfortable handling or using in their household routinely. There are some acetic acid washes that can be used in certain settings, but it's not the typical household vinegar concentration.
Dr. John Ahoro is with us, infectious disease specialist at Mayo Clinic. He's here to answer your questions about COVID-19. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Dr. John Ahoro, infectious disease specialist at Mayo Clinic, who's answering your coronavirus questions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a question about what we know about the disease and how it spreads, what kind of treatment might be on the horizon, anything about testing, 800-642-1234 is the number. Back to your calls now. Stan is with us in Green Bay. Stan, hello.
Yeah, hi. I just heard on the news that 75% of the patients on ventilators are men, and that 80 to 90% of the actual fatalities are men. And I'm wondering why the doctor thinks that is, and if there's something protecting women, if there's something that we can do to, you know, lower the fatality rate.
Stan, thanks for the call. I haven't seen those specific numbers, Dr. Ahoro, but I have seen references that men seem to be more prone to this.
Yes, that definitely is true, and that's an association that, as of yet, is not really well understood. We've seen that very consistently going across the reports coming out of China and Europe and throughout Asia and now in the U.S. that men do seem to be at higher risk for more severe disease and higher risk for mortality. And the exact nature of why that might be is really anybody's guess at this point. It's going to be a fruitful area of research for some time, but I don't have a satisfying answer.
Thanks a lot for that call. We got an email from Pat who says their 28-year-old son had symptoms back in the middle of March after riding a train, testing not available to people at the time. He's since recovered. He didn't call his provider at the time. Should they ask him, their question is, to get tested now that he has recovered? Would there be any benefit in that?
Sure. So there's a couple of potential roles for testing after disease at this point. Mostly it's not indicated for routine purposes, but there is concern that people may start shedding virus once their symptoms have resolved if they have any kind of immune compromising condition and it's still relatively recent after their course of illness. So for some patients, even when their symptoms are resolved, we still are testing them with the nasal swab to look for any kind of virus. That's a very small group of patients. Now, the other test, which is probably the one that they're more interested in this case, is the serology test, where we look for an antibody indicating that the immune system has had a response to COVID, and that would confirm that that is indeed what that illness was at that point. There isn't much to do with that information right now on an individual case level. We don't know for sure right now if that test indicates that somebody's actually immune or just that they've merely been exposed. There's plenty of diseases where we have tests that show exposure on these antibodies without actually conferring a long-term immunity or protection to this. But there are some emerging studies coming out now that are doing some treatments with convalescent plasma, meaning that they tried to take the blood of people who have recovered from infection, distill it down to the antibody component, and administer to some ill individuals. Mayo and several other large institutions have trials along these lines and are doing that kind of testing. But outside of those sort of trial settings, it's somewhat questionable if there's a reason to do that kind of test right now. So overall, I'd say there's not any great indication to do that, but as for a general healthy 28-year-olds, but there are plenty of specific scenarios where a doctor would be a very appropriate to recommend testing for one of these research studies.
Time for one more caller. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to also add to wearing the cloth mask. Beyond sneezing and coughing, doesn't it also help just if a person's talking, they tend to sometimes spit a little bit, any water droplets and things like that?
Yes, there is benefit to the masks just beyond the coughing and sneezing. That is the most visible part of that. But we've all met people who spit when they talk, and catching some of that certainly has some benefit. But probably the most significant benefits we get from the masking is a constant reminder to not touch our face. A lot of things are transmitted from us touching things, not cleaning our hands before we touch our face, and then infecting ourselves that way, or taking virus away from our face and touching other surfaces that other people touch. It also acts as something of a constant reminder to keep that social distance between you and the next person if you're wearing that mask. So the benefits go beyond just the cough or sneeze. For sure, those are just some of the more visible benefits of it.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute or so, Dr. Ohoro, I know you worry in general about passing diseases on in healthcare settings. Can you talk about the precautions briefly that we're taking for COVID-19 in healthcare settings?
Sure. So in healthcare settings now, we're doing a lot more testing because of that increased testing availability to try to make sure we know among patients who are in the hospital who's at the highest risk for transmitting disease to minimize the chances of transmission within the hospital. That also includes more aggressive testing of healthcare workers who have compatible symptoms. But beyond that, there is a more aggressive approach to wearing masks for healthcare providers so that there is less of a chance of us acting as a potential route of transmission, and using more personal protective equipment in the form of those surgical grade masks, gowns, gloves for suspected cases to just not track virus out of that room. Between having a better idea of which cases we need to be the most cautious with and having a higher index of suspicion and a higher grade of protection than we normally would before COVID, these measures seem to do a reasonable job of mitigating that risk of spread within hospital settings. And it's important to know that hospitals really are not the hot spot at the moment, because something that's been more and more evident across the nation is that people are avoiding going to the hospital when they need it. There have been increased incidences of people waiting for when they have appendicitis and other severe illnesses before they go to the ER. And that has, in some areas, the risk of people waiting to go to the ER or not going to the ER where they need to has led to more deaths and more poor outcomes than COVID in those same areas.
So we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Dr. John Ohoro, infectious disease specialist at Mayo Clinic, with us to answer questions about COVID-19. WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a new series called Outbreak Wisconsin. Mariah Clark is many things, a blacksmith, a tall ship sailor, and an EMT. She's also an emergency room nurse at UW Health in Madison. She's been keeping an audio diary to share her experience as a frontline worker during the pandemic.
It's about 3:30 in the morning, and I'm sitting on my front porch in the darkness. This is normally when I'd be getting off of work, but I've had a couple of days off, and so I'm awake. Everyone else, of course, is asleep, except for the neighbor on the corner across from my house. They're always awake when I go to bed. I work at arguably the best prepared and equipped hospital in the state. We put off elective surgeries. We discharge anyone who's stable to go home. We limit visitors. And some days are really busy and really bad, and we see a lot of deaths. And then there's other days that just feel tremendously normal. So it is April 10th, a Friday, a beautiful, bright, sunny day, and I'm walking into work from the parking garage. It used to be you could walk in any door, but now I think there's only 6 entrances, maybe, and you have to wear your badge to be let into the building and get screened. Just a few questions. Make sure that you're safe and healthy to come to work. Morning.
Hello, are you self-monitoring?
Yes, self-monitoring. Nope. You too, thank you. So now I'm walking along a little blue tape line that shows us where to go and keeps us separate from the people exiting the building. And I'll go to my locker room, change into hospital scrubs, put my hair up under a cap, and put on the same N95 mask or surgical mask that I've been using for 3 weeks, and then a plastic face shield over that. It's a little more involved than it used to be to get ready for work. So I'm driving home from work, and I don't know if you can hear the car around me, but I can hear all the squeaks and the wind and everything. Today wasn't what I can call a bad day at work. We're still seeing fewer patients than we usually do, but at the same time, because more of what's coming in is true emergencies, I think it feels like there's more death. And yet still, it couldn't be called a bad shift by our normal metrics. Today, I had my first friend die of COVID. Not acquaintance, not patient, but friend. And I can't help but wonder, even though I'm not actually superstitious by nature, whether that was why I got suddenly sad yesterday. So I'm gonna go home and light some candles and sink into my bathtub with a nice glass of whiskey. And then I'll be ready to face another day tomorrow and go back to work.
This story is part of Outbreak Wisconsin, a new series from WPR and Wisconsin Watch. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, COVID-19 is a tough topic for any family, but it can be especially difficult for people with family members dealing with memory loss from Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. Our guest shares some advice. Trash and recycling pickup are very essential services still going on during the pandemic. We'll look at the workers performing the vital job and the kind of protections that are and aren't in place for them. And retail was already changing a lot, and the disease outbreak could have a lasting impact on the way we shop. We'll get some of the latest developments, and you can join in with your thoughts and experiences. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, a lot of Americans are out of work, and for many that means they're losing health coverage in the midst of a health emergency. Kate's guests share advice on health insurance options. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. then anxiety disorders have become a lot more common for American children in recent years. We'll talk about the stress that puts on parents and some of the most effective ways to help kids in the long run. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.